restart?
Okay, I'll start in 10 seconds. Okay, I'm going to do the introduction when we actually play back the tape. Do you think of there as being any themes that unify your four books, your four novels?
Well, I think one of them is the promises that people make or seem to make to each other, and the ways in which they very often fail to keep those promises. I don't so much mean verbal promises as the process of appearing to offer to each other some kind of love or safety or refuge, and the ways in which they just fail to come through, and the ways in which people choose to perceive in other people love or safety or refuge, and how they deceive themselves in that perception. And also, I think the difficulty of behaving decently by the day, let alone doing good, just behaving decently seems to me to be much more difficult than most people realize.
You've also in your novels kind of crystallized certain political or social events of our time and have written about them in novel form. Is that conscious on your part? Do you see yourself as a writer who writes about your time?
I feel very much that I'm of the time, and that my work is of the time. I really find it impossible to stay away from politics, and since I can't stay away from politics, I'm bound to the time I live in, which I think is part of my responsibility in a way. Part of my responsibility as a writer.
Why?
Well, because I believe that writers of fiction itself is something that's necessary, and I think in order to make our way through the present times, we often have to refract reality into narrative and turn it into stories so that we can examine it in much the same way that cognition requires dreams just to clean the circuits and so forth. So I think that working as a teller of stories in this particular time is serving the time, and I feel that I'm doing my job, that I have a job and that I'm doing it.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your life. You had what strikes me as a very difficult childhood. Your mother, first of all, was schizophrenic. Were you aware that there was something wrong when you were growing up?
I was aware fairly early on that there was a bias between my mother's perception and reality. But I fairly early on began to try and cover for her. I felt I had a twofold job, really. The first one was to make my own way and figure out what was happening, because I wasn't getting it straight from her. And the next part of it was to try and cover for her to some degree. So I think most individual schizophrenics and people who've lived with schizophrenics get to comprehend the shorthand, the schizoid shorthand that the particular person they know speaks. So I pick that up, I think, as easily as a child will pick up another language.
Did she frighten you?
Never.
How does she support you?
Well, she originally had been a school teacher in the New York City school system, but she lost her job when I was about four. And she made her living as a hand addresser of envelopes. For a while, she worked as a chambermaid in the old Savoy Plaza Hotel. But for the most part, she was either a hand addresser of envelopes or an inserter of envelopes. This was for mail order companies in the days when before addressographs. She had a very nice hand, and it was somewhat in demand to have attractively hand-addressed mailers. As a result of doing this for years and years, her fingers became terribly deformed and arthritic. Her hand was twisted, completely twisted by it.
And you didn't know your father or didn't live with your father?
Didn't live with him. Didn't know him either.
Your mother was institutionalized when you were very young, and you were sent to an orphanage and then to a Catholic school. And I keep wondering what it must have been like for you to go from someone whose sense of reality was unpredictable, like you couldn't tell what kind of mood she'd be in or how she'd interpret things, to go from there to a basically authoritarian situation.
Well, it's difficult for me to recall some of these things in terms of their emotional valence on me. I think if they were painful, to defang the recollection a little bit. My mother was very affectionate. She was scrambled, but she was affectionate. She really did not serve me as any kind of authority. I was very fond of her, but I didn't pay much attention to what she said. So, I mean, I was an ill-disciplined small child because I really was getting, you know, I was sort of in charge of myself. The strongest, the impression I got when I was five, when I went into St. Anne's, was that of being hit. This was done by the Marist brothers, I think, in all innocence. I mean, they were not sophisticated individuals. Many of them were first and second generation French Canadians. Their attitude was, theologically, I guess, describable as Jansenism of a sort. They did believe in hitting little children. Not sadistically, particularly in most cases, but they did slap you around all the time. So I brought that with me right into adult life until I found myself in the Navy many years later, and it took me an awful lot of discipline and conditioning of myself not to cringe when people yelled at me. I developed a kind of a instinctive cringe. It's very hard to feel good about yourself when you tend to cringe. So I really had to... that was an aspect of my reactions that I had to work on, and that's something I picked up. I picked up in that place. Also, I picked up, I think, a knack for getting on with a whole lot of different sorts of people. Every place like that, whether it's a ship or a prison, a boarding school, an orphanage, I mean, is some kind of zoo. I mean, this anthropoid. This simian kind of order somehow imposes itself, in which the variously strong dominate the variously weak, and you have to make your way sort of between the various forces that are operating. Yeah, like the right time to fight, the right time not to fight, which, I mean, getting down to basics again. What sort of, if you sometimes felt that it was a matter of survival, what techniques were workable in what areas, you know, in terms of what clique, what to employ, when, all that sort of thing. Those are all things I think I picked up there. Those are useful in a practical way. They're not very pleasant to talk about or to consider, but they're useful.
Well, after that experience, when you got older, you went to the Navy for a few years, came back, lived in New York, and became really a part of bohemian life there. And I was thinking, well, maybe you would have had a lot of trouble fitting into the mainstream, even if you really wanted to, given the kind of experiences that you had before.
Yeah, this has occurred to me. I think one of the there are a number of things moved me toward becoming a writer. And one of them certainly was my childhood experiences, because as children will, I disappeared as much as I could into my imagination. And I was always telling myself stories about what was going on and turning it into narrative, and it became my primary survival mechanism. It became my way of keeping on an even keel, my balancer, was to turn things into stories. And there's a way in which if you can tell the tale, you're not overwhelmed. As long as there's somebody to say what's going on, like the messengers in Job, only I am returned alive to tell thee. I mean, I felt like I was still functioning. I was still all right as long as I could make it into a story. Make it into a story like the detectives on the radio and the old radio shows that we were allowed to listen to up until 10 o'clock at night.
So you were making things into stories in your mind, but what made you think when you were older that you could actually write and sell the stories and make a living at it?
I didn't really think that. I never thought it was possible. I think what you said earlier about my chance at the mainstream is probably right. I mean, I was in some ways somewhat eccentric in terms of the values of the 50s, in which the late 50s in which I came of age. So I pretty much naturally gravitated to the bohemian scene in New York. I was working at the other end of the spectrum and at the other end of the street, being 42nd Street. I was working for the Daily News. I was a copy boy on the Daily News. In those days, the Daily News was the old still envenomed Daily News, which sort of spoke to its audience out of the side of its mouth. And the people who worked there, the editors and so forth, were quite in keeping with the editorial position and style of the newspaper. And what they demanded from copy boys was principally neatness and conformity and quiet and hustle. None of these things I was particularly distinguished for. So they didn't like me much at the news, and I knew my days were numbered there. I was also trying to go to NYU during the day, and that wasn't working. And I was also trying to hang out at the Seven Arts Cafe at the at 9th Avenue and 42nd Street, which for a while in the late 50s was really an excellent place to hear poets like Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso and Ray Bremser and all the great poets of that era. And Kerouac often read there, always very drunk and so forth. And I don't know whether I thought I was learning anything about writing. I did sort of enjoy hanging out. I was a lot younger than the serious players. I did end up marrying the waitress there. I mean, so
to whom you're still married.
To whom I'm still married, yeah. Well, she had another job too. She was a guidette in the RCA building, and we worked roughly the same shifts, and after her shift on the RCA building, taking people to the Rainbow Room and to the observation booth, she'd change out of her uniform and get into her sort of beatnik regalia and run over to the Seven Arts. And,
My guest is novelist Robert Stone. Robert Stone's new novel is called Children of Light. Well, you went to New Orleans for a few years, which is the setting for your first novel, Hall of Mirrors, and you started writing that in California, I think on a fellowship there.
I guess I actually started writing it in New York, because I spent a brief period in New York on the basis of the beginning of the book. I got a Stegner Fellowship to Stanford. Yeah,
you started in California, becoming involved with the Ken Kesey and the Merry Prankster scene, which is the most celebrated acid tripping group of people from the 1960s. And I'd really like to hear your comparison of what the West Coast and the East Coast counterculture was like at the time.
Well, the way I remember it was like going from black and white to color. I mean, we were living in an apartment between Avenue A and First in New York, and we suddenly found ourselves in this, what struck us, I mean, it was like everything turning color under this beautiful blue sky where there was just no equivalent for 4th Street between 1st and A. A place of that seemed tremendously gentle, where people were polite and soft-spoken, and where everything was just extraordinarily peaceful. I mean, I remember the California of 1962 with a great deal of affection. People used to say of San Francisco that it was like being stuck in the elevator at Lincoln Center. Nobody would say that today about San Francisco. San Francisco was a lot smaller in population and so forth. It was a real little jewel of a city.
How did you become involved with the Pranksters and Ken Kesey?
Well, the Pranksters, the idea of the Pranksters is kind of a joke. I mean, there wasn't exactly such a thing as the Merry Pranksters that came out of
Tom Wolfe.
Well, it wasn't Tom Wolfe. It's Tom Wolfe sort of seizing on one day's trip that somehow the concept of Merry Pranksters was introduced, and it stayed on the tapes. And it became a kind of running gag.
Yeah, I should mention here for listeners who aren't familiar with the book that he kind of immortalized that scene in his book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. So you just started hanging out with him?
Well, to demystify the Merry Pranksters a little bit, it would be possible to say that these were people, at least at the very beginning, these were people, almost all of whom connected in some way with Stanford, and who lived in the little bungalows, inexpensive bungalows in Menlo Park off the Stanford golf course. That's more, I mean, that's one way of looking at the Merry Pranksters. When I see Kesey's old films of us, I mean, we really look like a bunch of fraternity types, fraternity and sorority types playing around. You know, our hair is very short, and we just look like these early 60s collegians, which is very close to what we were.
When I think of you being out there, there's something about the tone of it that doesn't seem quite right, because you're from New York, and you'd had this almost bleak childhood, you know, in the orphanage and the Catholic school and your mother being institutionalized. And here you are with a group whose, you know, philosophy, at least the way Tom Wolfe tells it, is to, you know, like get high and take things as they come and, you know, have a great time and do all these hijinks whenever possible. And I really have to kind of stretch my imagination to imagine you going from the kind of life you'd been used to that kind of life. Did you fit in?
I think I fitted in fine. I mean, why be miserable when you can be on a party? I mean, I didn't feel any responsibility to reflect my earlier life, and I was quite happy to party for a few years.
So you kind of unburdened yourself of a lot of that.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was great fun, and I wouldn't have wanted I would not have wanted to miss it.
That group of people was, you know, doing a lot of LSD at the time and were among the first people to be doing it. I think it might have even been legal.
Yeah, it was legal by 1962. Actually, I had run across psychedelics before in 1959 on the Lower East Side when my wife and I were living down there. There was a man who ran an espresso. He was a follower of Ayn Rand, and he had a dollar sign out in front of his espresso in token of his fealty to Ayn Rand. And he ordered peyote cactus from a ranch in Texas, and he sold it. And we used to try to get as much down as we possibly could, which usually wasn't very much because it tasted really awful. And we'd get a certain buzz off that. However, when we got to California a couple of years later, we had arrived in the land where psychedelic drugs were definitely available and in general use. They were being used on an experimental basis, I think, at the Veterans Hospital in Palo Alto for the treatment of alcoholism. They were also being used, I think, in Czechoslovakia by Stanislaus Grof about the same time. There was a general feeling in therapy that LSD could be useful, possibly in modifying behavior as a behavior modification. A supervised dosage of lysergic acid could be used for behavior modification. Presumably, we have now heard, of course, of cases of the Army testing it for military purposes and even on unwitting subjects, which seems to me to be unthinkable, really.
What effect did LSD have on you when you started using it regularly?
Well, it's hard to say. Sometimes it was, for the most part, it was... It served as a euphoriant. Occasionally, it was rather frightening. Things got a bit fast and furious. It was a workout. I mean, you'd wake up in the morning after you finally got to sleep, and with your jaws aching, and you'd realize that this was because you had been smiling for 11 hours. You'd been walking around with this beatific smile on your face. I think when we were doing it, there were a number of psychologists in this group, had the sense that we were really, I mean, I think for the psychologists, they were trying to explore aspects of the mind that they found useful. So they saw this as really useful play. For the artists, we were really continuing. I thought we were continuing an old tradition. I mean, Juan Miro had taken psychedelics. A number of painters had. Henri Michaux. There was a tradition going back to the 90s of using various kinds of psychedelic drugs and in art to stimulate and to generally shake up the creative capacity. It certainly didn't occur to me that it was going to become a mass phenomenon. How has it affected me? I'm not altogether sure. I think it did probably put me back in touch with the religious instincts that I had shaken off at about 16. I was very religious when I was a small child, and up until about the age of 15 or so. And then with a great feeling of liberation, I just stopped believing. And it took me a while to discover that in sloughing off the religious part of my life, I had really left a gap that was not filled with anything else. And something seemed absolutely to be missing. And I was past the level of credence that would enable me to believe again, because really the tenets of the Christianity that I required were simply unacceptable to me on an intellectual basis. Perhaps taking the drugs put me back in touch with those religious impulses.
With organized religion, or just with the ideas that religion also addresses?
The religious aspects of things in general, the religious approach to existence, rather than the logical positivist approach.
A lot of people who came of age in the 60s and spent a lot of time taking psychedelics and experimenting with things like that renounced it afterwards and made as serious a change in their life after the 60s as they had made during the 60s. Did you ever go through a period of that, or do you still feel connected to that part of your life?
I feel absolutely connected to that part of my life. I never reformed or swore off. I haven't used psychedelic drugs for, I would think, over 15 years, and I have no expectation that I ever will again. But I really don't feel the impulse. I don't feel the desire to. to scramble my mind and to exhaust myself. I mean, I think I'm perhaps a little too old to spend 11 hours smiling. And to go through all that work, because it really is a workout taking acid. I think it was a youthful diversion, and I was young, and we were all young, and for the most part, nothing bad came of it for us. As I said, I didn't realize that it was going to become a mass phenomenon. If I had realized that, I think perhaps I would have been a little more hesitant about it. I sometimes had the feeling, I've said this before, that I went to a party sometime in 1963, and the party just somehow spilled out of the house and down the street and into town until it covered the world. And by 1968. That party that I went to in 1963 had transmogrified and spread itself in little shards and splinters all over the Western world.
You left the party after a couple of years. Why? So that you could get more writing done?
Basically, I just physically removed myself from California, and because I wasn't finishing my first book. I was really the book was changing as I changed, partly as I grew older, partly as my attitudes changed. I started out to write a fairly realistic novel, and that changed. So in some ways, all that time and perhaps a few of those trips were useful in my discovering the kind of style that I wanted to, that I would ultimately use.
Earlier you said that when you went from New York to California, it's like everything went from black and white to in color. You went back to New York again to finish your first novel. Was it as if all the color was being drained out of life and you were going back to black and white land afterwards?
Well, it was a little bit like that. Another thing that was rather frustrating was nobody knew what I was talking about. Everybody thought I had just gone crazy. Everybody that I knew in New York, I was babbling about strange empires of the mind, and people thought I just lost my wits among the lotus eaters.
My guest is novelist Robert Stone. His new novel is titled Children of Light. Your first book was Hall of Mirrors, which is the book that you were finishing up when you moved to New York. And your second book came out about, I think, 7 years after that. You had said to somebody in an interview that you felt like you put everything you knew into that first book. Were you really scared afterwards that you'd have nothing left to write about because you'd already put it into that first book?
I really tried not to let myself get scared. I thought, well, when it's ready to come, it'll come. But I certainly suffered from the loss of innocence that a writer goes through when he or she publishes their first work. When you write your first one, you really, for the most part, don't expect it to be published. You really think that nobody's going to read it except you and your girlfriend or boyfriend, and that it's not going any farther than that. So you have a freedom that you'll never ever get back after you've been published once, and you write with the suggestion of somebody looking over your shoulder.
You went to Vietnam in 1971 for a couple of months. You weren't there as part of the military. You were there as a journalist. Did you go there specifically hoping that you'd find material for the next book?
In a way, I went there partly because it was such a tremendous preoccupation of that decade, and such a tremendous preoccupation of everybody I knew. I mean, we were all very intensely involved in the Vietnam War, one way or another. All of us, all my friends, and I thought, well, I'm really not getting anything done here. This is going on, and I'm full of opinions about it. I think I'll just see if I can't get somebody to send me over there.
So you did. You got.
So I did. I got
newspaper.
I got Ink, which was a London imitation of the Village Voice, which didn't last very long, but lasted long enough to send me over there and let me get my accreditation. And so in 1971, in the early part of 1971, I was over there. The main story that broke in that period was Lamsan 719, the South Vietnamese incursion into Laos, which I did not see. I did not get up to see. 71 was, for the most part, except for Lamsam 719 and some heavy fighting around Fubai, it was a fairly quiet time there. I did get up to Fubai, and I did get down to the Delta. Most of the time I was in Saigon because an old friend of mine who I knew from Paris had asked me to look up her boyfriend who was working in Saigon as a freelance journalist. So I looked him up, and I found that he had a heroin habit and was involved fairly deeply with the dope scene in Saigon. And I thought, well, here perhaps is a story of the dope scene in Saigon. And before I knew it, I knew much more than I wanted to about the dope scene in Saigon.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that I just thought I knew too many people, and too many people knew I knew it. There was no explanation for me. I was staying at a hotel run by a Corsican who was himself involved there was this triangular trade involving heroin and cinnamon and gold. It was all so complicated and crazy that I can hardly believe it was real, but it was real. And my friend's friend wanted me to introduce him to the Corsicans. He wanted to do business with them. He used to drive around Saigon in a pickup, and we went to some extraordinary places that, again, seem hallucinatory. I could swear they were caves in that they were down in basements, but they can't have been because there aren't any basements in Saigon. The water table's too high. Anyway, I got a good, close, hard look at the drug scene in Saigon, which consisted really of a lot of people smoking heroin. Nobody was shooting it. People would put it on a joint, on a joint of marijuana, and smoke it. That was the way it was normally used.
Your novel, which comes out of that Vietnam experience, Dog Soldier, starts with a journalist who's in Vietnam, an American, bringing back heroin that he's really just a courier of to America, and with that heroin comes a lot of the problems, I think, that we associate with the war, a lot of the violence, and were you trying to show there the kind of war that we created in Vietnam coming back to infect our own culture?
Oh yes, I mean very much that, and also to underscore the irony of a juxtaposition between the affluence of America and the party that was still in progress, and the fact that all this dying and death and maiming was going on the other side of the Pacific. And of course, by 1971, the party was really on the American side of the Pacific was really beginning to die down quite a bit. In fact, some of the ugly aspects of the 60s, which had been suppressed, began to surface.
Like what? What do you see as the ugly parts of it that started surfacing?
Well, I mean, in this freedom, this suggestion of "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," there was a kind of an antinomian element that was very likely to end in paranoid delusion and so forth, and in fact did end in paranoid delusion. I mean, that was the downside. The downside was always there. It was always there within the drugs. The drugs had the capacity to delude, and to, you know, the euphoria could sometimes make people feel that they were all powerful, that they were messianic, or that their friends were messianic. I mean, that was always possible. And that began to be around 1971 what we were seeing more and more of. We were also coming to realize that people were sometimes permanently damaged by these drugs. And as a result, were sometimes violent.
That also, I think, sums up a lot of what your book is about, that kind of paranoid delusion from the drugs, the ugly side of it. Mm-hmm. There is a very powerful scene in your novel, Dog Soldiers, in which someone who's dealing heroin and using it himself is asked to sell some to a couple who are upper middle class or, you know, very comfortable, and the man of the couple is a writer, and he wants to learn something about heroin. He's experienced a lot of other drugs, and he wants to be able to write about the scene and just try it himself and meet some of the people who do it. So he and his wife come, and the person who's dealing is just so angered by this dilettante approach to just like getting in touch with the scene that he's really kind of trapped in at this point, that he intentionally ODs them. He shoots them up with doses, kills one, and leaves another just throwing her guts up.
He doesn't actually kill. I mean, it's a little unclear in the book about Gerald. I don't mean Gerald actually to die. I kind of leave that unresolved. It does appear that way, but
he doesn't even wait to find out.
He doesn't
if he's
wait
dead
to
or
find
not.
Out. He gives him. He definitely lets him have it right in the vein, and he. He could perfectly well have died.
And I was yeah, you're going
to
say something.
No, I was only going to say that that is unclear in the book, and I suppose I should have made it a little clearer in the novel.
I was wondering if you saw both sides of the fence on that one, and I was wondering if in a way you ever felt like that couple yourself, like going to Vietnam to encounter the war, but not really being there to fight it, not even being there long term as a journalist, like going for
absolutely.
For 2 months.
Absolutely. I mean, that scene in a way is a parody on me. I mean, in a way, I can't put myself in my own book in the same way that I can't do a character from life. But you know, I think there's a lot of black comedy in that scene, I think, and the joke was really sort of on me. Intentionally, I am making a reference to myself, even though, I mean, I was not that outrageous a dilettante, but at my voyeurism, my involving myself in the war and in those drugs, more or less with motives that were, you know, I think honorable, I was nevertheless. In the section with Gerald, having making a joke, a rather grisly joke about myself.
Did you see the other side too, though?
Oh, absolutely.
Really, disliking sure. That kind of dilettantism.
Yes, I mean, I was looking at it from both sides, as the song of the period says. I was seeing it from both sides.
The novel that you wrote, based on Vietnam, was called Dog Soldiers. And then a few years after that novel was published, you went to Latin America, and that trip became the subject of your subsequent book. What first got you to those countries? You went to Honduras, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua, and I think it was in 1977.
Around then, yeah. Well, what first got me down there was that I gave a reading at the University of Alabama, and I had $1,000 in my pocket as a result of the reading. And I thought I had taken up scuba diving, and I thought I'm going to go down to the Bay Islands, where the best diving in the world is, and see if my old friend and his wife are still there, because friends of mine had taken off for the Bay Islands. So I just had a couple of drinks and went to New Orleans Airport and bought myself a ticket to San Pedro Sula. But when I woke up, it was my decision had been made. I was on my way to Honduras, whether I wanted to go there or not. So I followed through, and I went out to first to Utila, the island of Utila, and then to Roatan. And while diving in Roatan, I did not find my friend and my friends, but I did meet an American in the diplomatic service stationed in Managua who was driving south with his sister-in-law and his wife. And he asked me if I wanted to ride to Managua. So I said, sure. I wasn't doing anything particularly. I packed up my diving gear and we all went to Managua. And at that point, there was no insurrection in progress as far as I could tell. There had just been an election in Salvador in which Jose Napoleon Duarte had won the election, but he had been denied it by the army in the person of General Romero, who beat him very badly, which is why Duarte looks like he looks, because he was given a terribly bad beating by Romero and Romero's men. That was the big story in Central America at that time, and it was on page 12. I mean, nobody really was aware of Central America as doing anything but continuing its cycle of coups d'état and revolution, so forth. Revolution with a small R rather than a capital R. And I, as a matter of fact, I actually got to be in the same room with the late President Somoza very briefly. An experience which I don't exactly treasure, but it
was this a party or something?
Yeah, it was a big diplomatic function. He was there. Somoza, as those who knew him will recall, spoke unaccented English. He sounded just like an American. He had gone to high school in America. Well, anyway, there I was, and when I got back, I tried to get back to the novel that I'd been writing, but I was really haunted by recollections of things I'd seen there and things I'd heard. So I went back again, and this time went to Guatemala, crossed into Honduras from Guatemala. Again, went back to Nicaragua, which still seemed to be intact. I mean, there were a few rumors of insurgencies, but nothing I could make any very much sense out of. And I finally went back a third time. This time I was talking to some nuns. I had a distant relation who's a Marinol nun. I had talked to her, to a number of other people, particularly to a Filipina nun who worked in Managua, who was sort of giving me the score on what was going on. And by then, I had a very minor run-in with the police in Honduras. They wanted to know what I had come, three times in a year and a half to Honduras for. And, of course, my Spanish wasn't very good, and it remains not very good. And they found it rather difficult to believe that somebody who spoke such dreadful Spanish could be constantly coming to Honduras. But it wasn't serious. I mean, I didn't, I mean, nothing bad happened to me.
Two of the characters are religious who are in your Central American novel, A Flag for Sunrise. There's a priest and a nun in it. And I wonder if you worked in any of the religious issues that were important to you at the time through their characters.
Indeed, I did.
In what ways?
Well, in Egan's attempt at faith. I mean, he finds himself abandoning orthodoxy and taking up this Gnostic position, which is, the difference between orthodoxy and Gnosticism on one level is that while orthodoxy insists that the world is good and creation is good, Gnosticism says that the material world is not, that the material world basically is illusion, that it's fundamentally evil, and that God essentially has been destroyed and has to be reassembled by each and every human being. Each and every human being carries a small spark of the divine essence, and the great game is to sort of put it together and thus obviate the evils of the material world. So the question of, the fundamental religious question to me, in a way, is why is it that we are out here in this stuff? Or is there a why? Wittgenstein, I think, asked the question, I think it was Wittgenstein, why is there something rather than nothing? I mean, I see that as a fundamentally religious question.
When you started writing A Flag for Sunrise in 1977, not that many Americans were really aware of what was happening in Central America, but when the book was published in 81, Nicaragua had gone through revolution. The question of money for El Salvador is one of the front page stories of the time. Did you find all this a mixed blessing?
I didn't know quite what to think. I was certainly overtaken by events. I mean, no nuns had been killed when Sister Justin in my book dies. It was a mixed blessing. Very difficult for me to reconcile. But I think I was calling the attention of the literate part of the United States to the situation in Central America. I think it would have. I would rather that all the bad things had not happened, and that perhaps the country's attention might have been focused on Central America before all these troubles descended on the area. But that wasn't the way it turned out.
My guest is novelist Robert Stone. His new novel is titled Children of Light. Your new novel, Children of Light, is set in Hollywood. Did you ever worry that people would think it's a trivial setting compared to what your previous novels had been? Your last two were set in Central America and then Vietnam and the veteran coming back, the journalist from Vietnam coming back to America.
Well, I didn't let myself worry about that much. I think I have a touch of that reaction in some of the reviews, although they have been favorable. Some of them have felt that this the Hollywood milieu was trivial compared to my other subjects. But I think it's really relevant to American reality. I think it plays the film industry traditionally in terms of what it is and what it was. Is an extreme condition. I'm given to placing my characters in extreme conditions, and the movie business is an extreme condition if there ever was one. And maybe it was just my rite of passage as an American novelist to write my my Hollywood novel. I had to finally write it.
Well, I think of there as being two main Hollywood genres, one being the good beach novel, the Jackie Suzanne or Jackie Collins type Hollywood book, and the other being the serious American writers who've written about Hollywood, like Nathaniel West, Day of the Locust, and Scott Fitzgerald, The Last Tycoon. Do you see yourself as being a part of that either of those genres?
I think my novel is perfectly readable on the beach. I urge everyone to take Children of Light to the beach with them. On the other hand, I don't think that it is primarily of the beach genre, although it does fit in your beach bag. And finding a shady place and reading it would be, I think, rewarding, and I urge everybody to do that. It's a serious novel, and it's not. Its humor comes out of some difficult places. One of the things that arrested my attention, I think, in the movie business is the kind of gratuitous cruelty, the brutality of the vocabulary of communication there, and I think it's the huge amounts of money and the power that's somehow corrupting in the most elemental and obvious way. I mean, there's subtle corruption and there's obvious corruption. And the corruption in Hollywood, it seemed to me, is quite obvious and open. You wouldn't call it wholesome, but it's you'd call it unwholesome, but it certainly is upfront.
You've had several Hollywood experiences. You've written two screenplays or two first drafts of screenplays based on your novels. WUSA, the movie, was based on your first novel, Hall of Mirrors, and Who'll Stop the Rain was based on your second novel, The Dog Soldiers. Were you pleased with the way the movies turned out?
Well,
did they resemble the screenplays that you wrote?
WUSA resembles nothing on God's earth that I had ever had anything to do with. I mean, it is a bad and boring movie, and my story is that's not my fault, and it's true. My story is true. I simply could not get the visual world of the of the book into the director's consciousness, nor could he or did he try to render it. I mean, we were just working at totally at odds, and the result was a disastrously bad, boring film about which the less said, the better. Now, in the case of Who'll Stop the Rain, I mean, the very existence of that title says something about my experiences in Hollywood. I mean, I write a book. It's called Dog Soldiers. That's not a bad title. It's pretty punchy. It's it evokes a lot of things from the history, from military history, and the Dog Society of the Plains Indians is one of the things I was thinking of. Anyway, I thought it was a perfectly satisfactory title, but the people in the pyramid, the heads of Transamerica, who were running UA at the time, decided that they would take power away from these Hollywood zanies and take a business-like approach. They took some kind of sampling, I'm given to understand, in the Southwest, and learned as a result of it that women in that area dislike dogs and soldiers. Now, I don't believe that. I think women, especially in that area, probably kind of like dogs and soldiers. But nevertheless, that title was, they put their heads together, and I guess they listened to the soundtrack, and they called the picture by the name of one of the Creedence Clearwater songs that's on the track, Who'll Stop the Rain. The only problem is that Who'll Stop the Rain is a terrible, terrible title. It sounds like a Swedish diphthong. to start with, and it is not a picture that you'd go out to see. So I got in an argument with the producer to the effect of, you know, why do you pay me to write if you think you can do it better than me? You know, I give you a title, you pay me a lot of money, and then you don't take my title. You know, if you think you can write better than me, why do you hire me? But this availed me nothing. It also probably lost me a few paperback sales too, because it's kind of unfortunate when a film is made and the title is changed and the paperback is out, you like to have the title be the same. However, readers of Steve Bock's book about Heaven's Gate will know that Who'll Stop the Rain was sabotaged by the head of distribution at UA because he detested it. Huh. And then when it began to get on a few of the... It began to get good reviews and get on a few 10 best lists, he sort of had to scurry to cover himself. I think it's neither a very good movie nor a very bad one. I think it has fine performances and is for the most part, you know, a rewarding movie. I have lots of complaints about it, but I wouldn't put it on the same level with WUSA at all.
Would you put yourself through this experience again?
I wouldn't do the script of Flag for Sunrise for $5 million or $10 million or $15 million. There are some things that money just isn't worth. And no matter how much they would pay me, it wouldn't be enough. I would never do it, nor would I do Children of Light.
But maybe you'd do a screenplay of something that wasn't based on one of your books.
I think if somebody came along with a real snappy little mystery story, I think it might be fun to do. I'd think about that.
My guest is novelist Robert Stone. Many of the characters in your novels have had problems with alcohol, cocaine in your new book, heroin. Have you ever feared for yourself that you'd like give in to some habit that would, you know, adversely affect your life and your writing?
Well, I think many people, many writers do. I don't know if I feared it. I think I've come through so far, but I know a lot about substance abuse because I've seen a lot of it. And I certainly know, I think everybody's now seeing the effects of cocaine, a very insidious and very dangerous drug, which for the most part, almost anyone in the country can get hold of by making one phone call. And, you know, one of the things I want to do with this book is to comment on that. I don't think the picture that emerges of cocaine in Children of Light is very glamorous.
No, it's definitely not.
Right. So, I mean, that's one piece of small social positive action that that I can make. I have had my difficulties with one substance or another, but so far I prevail.
After throwing yourself into all these action kind of situations, going to Vietnam, going to Central America, being in the thick of Hollywood for a while, you're living now in New England in a house that's basically just outside of the woods, the way I understand it, and it sounds like a very nice, comfortable life. Do you need that kind of stability to write? And do you feel like you're going to have to throw yourself back into some kind of action scene again in order to have material for future books?
Well, I think I'm entitled. And of course, it's
entitled
much,
to the stability.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And of course, it's much easier to work. Writing is hard. It's very hard to start. It's self-starting. It's lonely. It's infinitely more easy when you have an organized regimen, when you have quiet, when you have order, when you have time. All things arranged, everything in place. I mean, those are the ideal working conditions, I think, for any artist. I mean, I could never understand how writers or painters or anyone else could work in circumstances of disorder. I really can't. I can't work intoxicated in any way. Even if I have a hangover these days, I can't really work the next day. I really need the peace and order. As far as throwing myself back into things, I may continue to work as a journalist. I think if there's any situation that cries out to me as much as Vietnam did years ago, I think I might put on my old trekking gear and go out and look into it.
Given the divorce rate and everything, it's really amazing to me that you're still together with your wife who you met when you were 20 or something. And it seems, just from having reviewed your life, it seems like several lives ago that marriage started. And I wonder if it's very important for you to have that kind of family base and family stability given the rough family life that you had when you were young.
Yes, it was, in a way, the antidote to because I was either going to have that, I think, the kind of marriage that I do have, the kind of situation that I have, or I was going to have just more disorder, which people like me, people with backgrounds like mine, are often very good at creating the kind of creating personal disorder and making their lives disorderly. And with a lot of help from the lady, I didn't do that.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.